A year and a half ago, a video of gender medicine experts went viral. On it, they talked about how hard it is to talk with teenagers about whether they might want to have kids one day.
It's always a good theory that you talk about fertility preservation with a 14-year-old, but I know I'm talking to a blank wall. And the same would happen for a cisgender kid, right? They'd be like, ew, kids, babies, gross. Or the usual stock answer is, I'm going to adopt. I'm just going to adopt. And then you ask them, well, what does that involve? Like, how much does it cost? Oh, I thought you just like went to the orphanage and they gave you a baby. No, it's not quite like that.
That's Dr. Daniel Metzger, and he's talking about the challenge of getting what's known as informed consent from children and adolescents to undergo procedures that will result in their sterilization. Over the last several years, doctors, medical experts, and the media have all said that the best way to help adolescents in distress about their gender is to give them puberty blockers, hormones, and surgeries to align their physical sex with their gender identity. The alternative to doing so, they said, was suicide. But now a new study released last month found no scientific evidence to support the claim that drugs and surgeries prevent suicide among people with gender dysphoria. Now, I agree we should be concerned about children and adolescents experiencing distress about their biological sex. But now there's even more evidence to warrant greater caution in how we treat them. Whistleblowers have given me the internal files from the main gender medicine organization, which is known as WPATH and stands for the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. The WPATH files show surgeons, therapists, and activists discussing internally how to treat people with gender distress. What they show is that what's happening is neither good science nor good medicine. There's a discussion, for example, about the blocking of puberty of a 10-year-old girl. There's a discussion of doing genital surgery on people with schizophrenia and a dissociative identity disorder, which used to be called multiple personality disorder. At the core of medical ethics is getting this informed consent from the people receiving the medicine or from their caregivers. The WPATH files show overwhelming evidence that the professionals within WPATH know they're not getting consent from children, adolescents, and vulnerable adults or from their caregivers. They know that so-called gender-affirming care can result in lifelong complications and sterility. Their patients do not understand the implications. Many patients are unaware that they will lose sexual function, including the ability to experience orgasm. After I received these files, my colleagues and I tried to report on them as we would journalists. We quickly became overwhelmed by the size and complexity of the project. And so we decided to write a full report about the files for Environmental Progress, our nonprofit research institute, in order to put the WPATH files in the context of the best available science about gender distress. The result is a new report, WPATH Files, Pseudoscientific Surgical and Hormonal Experiments on Children, Adolescents, and Vulnerable Adults. My colleague Mia Hughes wrote the report, and Alex Gutentag edited it. I'm proud to publish it and give it and the files away for everyone to read at environmentalprogress.org. The files aren't easy to read, but I urge you to do so. We believe the files show that what is called gender medicine is neither science nor medicine. The experiments are not randomized, double-blind, or controlled. And it's not medicine, since the first rule is to do no harm, and that requires, first and foremost, informed consent.
I think the thing you have to remember about kids is that we're often explaining these sorts of things to people who haven't even had biology in high school yet. And I know I've heard others in this kind of a setting say, well, we think adults are like really slick biologically, but in fact, lots of people have very little medical understanding of stuff like that. We just medical professionals and mental health professionals take for granted. But I don't know still what to do for the 14-year-olds. The parents have it on their minds, but the 14-year-old, it's like talking with diabetic complications with a 14-year-old. They don't care. They're not going to die. They're going to live forever, right? So I think when we're doing informed consent, I know that that's still a big lacuna.
I just wanted to piggyback on all of the importance that comes up with the informed consent issues. I often see people who, because there's such a backlog of therapists to do some of the mental health therapeutic support, I often see people who have already engaged in some sort of, and this is again with youth, who've already engaged in some sort of medical intervention, And so one of the things I do is I just kind of, I'm sitting with the youth and their parents and I say, oh, well, so tell me more about what you know about that medical intervention. And kind of like what Dan was saying, you know, children and young adolescents, we wouldn't really expect them. It's kind of a developmental, it's out of their developmental range sometimes to understand the extent to which some of these medical interventions are impacting them.
We do it, we try to talk about it, but most of the kids are nowhere in any kind of a brain space to really, really, really talk about it in a serious way. That's always bothered me, but you know, we still want the kids to be happier in the moment, right?
And I appreciate that much less with a 9, 10, or 11-year-old who's starting puberty suppression. And like Ren said, if they continue on, then and I mean, it's like developmentally not in their space to be able to have to think about that, and it shouldn't be, right? And so I think it is. I think it is a real growing edge in our field to kind of figure out how we can approach that. I'm definitely a little stumped on it. I try to kind of do whatever I can to help them understand best I can. But what really disturbs me is when the parents can't tell me what they need to know about a medical intervention that apparently they signed off for.
And I think now that I follow a lot of kids into their mid-20s, I'm always like, oh, the dog isn't doing it for you, right? Yeah, they're like, no, I just found this, you know, wonderful partner and now we're kids and da-da-da. So I think, you know, it doesn't surprise me.
I think the informed consent process is so important, and definitely that it's a process is really important to recognize, that it's not one conversation at one point in time, but is many conversations over time, and that those conversations don't have to stop once the an intervention has been started, that those conversations can be ongoing even after the intervention has occurred. And I think the case to me just highlights the need for, in addition to continued ongoing care, also maybe like leaving the door open that if this is your decision at this point in time, but that may change, and we're here to support you, whatever your decision is, and that you can always, you know, continue to see us, continue to see the team, keeping engaged with young people and letting them know that they can, it's okay to change your mind. It's okay to come back, and knowing that people sometimes have to disclose things in their own time as well. So that while we hope things are disclosed in real time, sometimes people just aren't in a place to face their trauma and what's going on. And so even more so becomes important, I think, to have that ongoing care.
I would go in and I would say, okay, so tell me what you learned from, and they'd just be like, we have no idea what they were talking about. Because they feel deferential. Part of it is that they feel less deferential to the kind of doctor I am than the kind of doctor the medical doctor is. And so, and because they really are seeking the care, they're just gonna say they know when they really aren't picking up on what's happening. And so I think the more we can normalize that it is okay to not get this right away, it is okay to have questions, the more we're going to actually do a real informed consent process than what I think has been currently happening. And that I think is frankly not what we need to be doing ethically.
Thanks, Diana. I appreciate those comments.